Victoria, pass the chops, please.
Judge Isaiah Monfort picked his teeth with a sweet gum twig while he waited for his second pork chop of the evening to come his way. He had the dignified air of a seasoned barrister and the pudgy jowls of a man who'd eaten a few more than his share of pork chops. He kept his thick silver hair combed straight back like a wood duck and sported a matching beard with no mustache, so he looked like a graying, well-fed President Lincoln. Mercy touched a cloth napkin to her lips and smiled. She liked to watch her husband eat. It pleased her when she could give him things he enjoyed. She recognized she was the flighty type, prone to fits of panic that rendered her incapable of rational thought. Isaiah was the stable force in her life, the rock-steady anchor to all her unsteadiness. She owed him more than he would ever know, more than he could possibly understand, and earnestly strove to make his life as easy and comfortable as a woman like her could. It had turned out to be such a perfect evening. Isaiah hadn't had any trials, and he was content to sit and chat about mundane things until Victoria decided to try her hand at a political debate. She handed over the plate of breaded chops and followed it with a dish of applesauce without being asked.
Papa, would you mind telling me why you're so against stockyards coming into Parker County?
Victoria batted her dark eyes with an air of contrived innocence and tossed her head so her long black hair flowed over her shoulders. She had a way of posing a question that let you know right away that she was absolutely positive your answer was going to be in error. The judge began to saw on the thick slab of pork with his silver-handled knife. His gold and ebony ring glinted in the lamplight. He spoke without looking up.
Mercy, we have got to get this girl married off. She should be giving us grandchildren instead of talking politics at the supper table. She's on the backside of her 20s and very near to looking 30 in the eye if I do my math right.
I know perfectly well how old I am, Father. That has nothing to do with my question, which, by the way, you have yet to answer.
Oh, can't this wait until after dinner? Oh, this has to be horrible for the digestion.
No, it's all right, Mercy. We raised up to be headstrong. I suppose I must shoulder the lion's share of responsibility for her willful ways. Maybe we should have sent her off to a convent years ago.
We're Presbyterians, Papa.
Well, drown you then. Yeah, that's it. Drown you as a pup. Or whatever it is we Presbyterians do with insulin daughters. Well, my dear, now if you are so set on discussing this, it's because of the type of people it would bring in. Rowdies, gunmen, and swindlers.
What about the jobs and the opportunities for the town, the whole county, to grow?
Well, there are those who think the stockyards would be the type of growth we need. I happen to disagree, and so do a lot of other intelligent people. Weatherford is a fine little town, and it will grow into a fine little city someday. All in due course. Stockyards are no.
Reed says the yards would help the economy in more ways than one.
What are you doing speaking to Reed Whitehead?
I should think you'd be happy. You and Papa are always after me to get married and give you grandchildren. Reed's a fine man. He's intelligent with a bright future. For pity's sake, Mother, his father's the sheriff.
The sheriff is a hard man, coarse and full of meanness. I don't know how he ever got elected.
I'll tell you how he got elected. He got elected because his rich financiers, the Crowders, bought him the job. I have to agree with your mother on this, my dear. You have to look at the whole situation and things such as this. It's touchy, and it's more convoluted than you can imagine. Old Silas Crowder stands to make a bundle if he can sell this worthless parcel of his land to the railroad for the stockyards. He as good as owns the Whiteheads. Any of them are bound to say whatever he wants them to. It's a damn hard road to hoe, being a judge in a county with a puppet for a sheriff.
Well, Reed is no more exactly like his father than I'm exactly like you.
Well, you're a grown woman. If you want the stockyards in town, then you are entitled to that opinion. But don't think it's the only way to think just because some young upstart happens to agree with you. Use some of the brain God gave you. Make up your mind for yourself,
Mother, Father.
Victoria finished her sweet tea and excused herself with a smile and a peck on the cheek for her father. These little conversations were nothing for those two, but they set Mercy's nerves on edge like fingernails on a writing slate. Her husband took a strong stand on this stockyard business, and whether he liked to admit it or not, there were a lot of people against him, a lot of cruel people like Sheriff Rance Whitehead. And now, to find out her own daughter was associating with his son. Mercy had worried that her husband might be facing trouble when she sent the telegram to Frank Morgan. Now she was certain her whole family was in danger.
Mind if I ask you a question? It's been eating on me for some time now.
Fire away.
Who is this Mercy Monfer? That she could get you on the road to recovery with a few words. I couldn't get you on your feet for near 2 months of trying.
That's a mighty fair question.
Frank reached into his vest pocket, took out his gold timepiece, and clicked it open. He replaced the watch and stood in the stirrups to survey the dull green row of post oak ahead of them.
I'll ask you a question, and then we'll see if you get an answer.
As you like to say, Frank, fire away.
Why are you tagging along like this? I showed you I was fine back there at the contest. It's not that I don't enjoy the company, mind you, but you told me yourself you have plenty of things you could be up to if you didn't have to fool with me.
I don't know. Reckon I'm just doing what rangers do. I'm ranging. Besides, it's eating me up inside to know about this long-lost love of yours. I mean, that's who Mercy is, isn't she?
Unless I missed my guess, that's Springtown up there. It's nearly 2, and I'm in a mind for a cup of coffee. If it's all the same to you, I'd like to chew on this for a bit, so when I do spit it out, it'll be something you can understand.
You up for a race with a short horse?
Son, I just got up from my deathbed a few weeks ago. I got a feeling I'll be forced to prove myself soon enough. Suppose I better mosey for a little spell yet.
Oh, I'm sorry, Frank. I should have known better. Now you got me feeling bad.
Oh, what the hell?
Giddy up!
Morgan dismounted in front of Neff's Cafe in downtown Springtown. Frank looped the Appaloosa's reins around a long cedar rail. The ride hadn't been such a good idea, but he was never one to back away from a challenge. His ribs felt like they were on fire, but he wasn't bleeding. That was a blessing. He didn't know how fast a body manufactured the red stuff, but he was pretty certain he was still a little shy of a full dram. Beaumont tied his stout quarter horse beside the Appaloosa. His hat was thrown back against his stampede string.
Wouldn't have been much of a race anyhow. With that little pony you got, I should have given you a half a mile head start.
What the hell was that all about? First you made me feel lower than an armadillo toe for not caring about your health, then you leave me in the dust.
Remember what I said about not holding on to life too tight.
It had been so long since he'd been back to North Texas that Frank felt like a stranger in places he'd once called home. He brushed the front of his breeches off and stomped his feet on the wooden sidewalk to get rid of any stray manure on his boots before he went into the glass-fronted establishment. Mrs. Neff was older than he remembered. She'd once been a handsome woman with long blonde hair she kept in a tight bun. He and Luke had often stopped by the cafe when they were out that direction just to lay their eyes on the pretty older woman. She'd likely been all of 25 at the time, but he and Luke had started pushing cattle at 12 and rounding up mavericks on their own when they were 13. To the two love-struck boys, Elizabeth Neff was a goddess of pure beauty. A creature so lovely, she was worth a day's ride and camping with the snakes 2 nights in a row just to gaze at her angelic face while they ate a piece of her pie.
And she was a damn fine cook, too.
She'd kept the bun, but it was gunmetal gray now. A little too much of her own good cooking had settled around her middle and hips. Her face, though aged, still held that timeless beauty that made it easy for Frank to see why he and Luke had taken such a fancy to the woman. Morgan picked a table in the back where he could see the door and watch Mrs. Neff at the same time. It gave him a good view of the door, but it also happened to be the same table he and Luke Perkins had sat at all those years ago to do their awestruck gazing. He laid both hands palms down on the table, as if he could get a feel of the past from the polished wood.
You all right, Morgan? You act like you know her.
Oh, you might say so. I used to spend a considerable amount of time here as a boy.
Mrs. Neff came to the table to take their order. Her sky-blue eyes still held the same sly smile and mischievous twinkle. Frank remembered why he and his friend had been so smitten.
A piece of pecan pie with a little dab of chocolate in it and a big cup of coffee.
You just asked for my speciality without me even telling you about it. I don't recognize you, and I doubt my pie is all that famous.
I grew up over near Weatherford, ma'am. When I was a boy, my friend and I used to ride out this way every chance we got.
Her lips pulled back into a shining grin. A sudden look of recognition flashed across the woman's face.
I declare, you're one of the Moon Boys.
I beg your pardon? I think you may have me.
Mrs. Neff wagged her finger and grinned from ear to ear. Her brightened eyes sparkled just as they had long ago. She put a hand to her chest and blushed.
No, I know it's you, Frankie, isn't it?
That's my name, but not Moon.
Of course it's not Moon. Frankie here used to come in with his friend Lucas and ogle me with their sad moon eyes so much, my husband told me that once they turned 16, he was going to have to shoot them both. Oh, Mr. Neff started calling them the Moon Boys whenever they'd come around. I don't mind telling you, Frankie, those were tough times for a young gal. What with all the Comanches raiding every time there was a dark night, hooligans coming around at all hours. It was a strain on the nerves, to be sure. You two youngsters did a lot for me back in those days. Kept me from getting old before my time.
I hope your husband's not still the jealous type.
No, I'm afraid poor Mr. Neff passed away a few years back. My lands, it's a good thing to see you again, Frankie. Puts me in such a mind of old times. You just sit right there and I'll go get your pie and coffee.
When she disappeared through a back door, Beaumont gave Morgan a sly look.
What else am I going to learn about you, old...
Hold it right there. If you're about to call me Moon Boy or anything close to it, I should remind you who I am and the parts of your body I might be inclined to shoot off when you're not looking.
All right, I get the message. Now, I'm ready to hear about you and Mercy. I think you ought to let me in on this little secret of yours before we ride into the middle of it and I look like a fool.
She's an old friend of mine, from back before the war. We were awful young.
She seems to think you are a man who could help her out of a predicament.
We kept in touch some after the war, but she never wanted me to come back. She married shortly after I left, had a child, a daughter.
How old's the daughter?
In her late 20s, I suppose. About your age.
Beaumont pondered that for a moment, his eyebrows alternately working up and down as he ruminated on the information and did the math in his head.
The telegram said she has your temper. Do you reckon she's...
Morgan was saved by the tinkling bell at the front door. A young man in blue canvas breeches and a pressed white shirt eyed the two men when he went to the counter. He wore a black Mexican-style holster and a nickel-plated Schofield revolver. His flat-crowned black hat looked fresh off the rack. Beaumont's ranger badge wasn't visible, so the man likely dismissed the two as a pair of worn-out drifters, which in Frank's case wasn't far off the mark. The newcomer pounded his fist on the counter. He acted like someone used to getting his way. He was so forward, at first Morgan thought he might be related to the Neffs. Mrs. Neff had her hands full with a tray of pie and coffee, and she bumped the kitchen door open with her hip. She was smiling until she saw the new arrival.
I'll be with you in a minute, Paddy.
Drop off their order and get to it. I haven't got all day.
Mrs. Neff set the tray on the next table and put Frank's coffee in front of him. Her hands shook enough to rattle the dishes. The gunfighter shot a quick look toward the kid at the counter, then back up at her.
Mrs. Neff, are you all right?
She cast her eyes at the ground while she got the pie. She fumbled with the saucer and dropped it on the ground, narrowly missing Frank's lap.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Her eyes were welling up with tears.
Move your fat arse, lady. You knew I'd be coming by on me rounds today.
Frank shook his head slightly to keep Beaumont in his seat. This was something he wanted to handle personally. He bent to help Mrs. Neff gather up the mess of pie and broken dish on the floor.
Leave it, and tend to me so I can be gone. I got other visits I'll be needing to make.
Frank wiped his hands on his pants and stood up straight, gently pushing Mrs. Neff behind him as he did.
Don't, Frankie. He'll kill you.
Paddy leaned back against the counter on both elbows, cocksure in his defiance. He acted as if he had a whole gang there with him.
Why don't you run along, youngster? It's likely time for your noon feeding.
I ain't hungry. What if I was? I'd eat your liver.
You know, I've heard nothing but guff coming from that mouth of yours since you walked in that door. I don't know what you think you got going in here, but let me clear something up for you. This nice woman is a friend of mine. Unless you have a strong desire to feel my boot in your ass, you'll be giving her an apology.
You're awful frail to be telling me about my own fair business.
Fair or not, there are ways of talking to a lady, and you don't seem to know 'em. I suggest you move your own arse on out of here before I move it for you.
Patty's eyes fluttered. Everyone had a telltale, a twitch or tick that preceded their move. For the young Irishman, it was his eyes. Before he drew, his eyelids fluttered as if they might roll back in his head like a rank horse. Glass shattered in the counter behind the astonished Patty as he dropped his pistol and slid to his knees. At the close range, the bullet had pierced his chest and crashed into the display counter behind him.
Who are you?
Frank Morgan.
Morgan. I thought... I've heard of you. Thought... You were out west.
Was. Thought I might try to come home for some peace and quiet.
Patty's eyes fluttered again. He got one last look at his blood-stained shirt before they closed for the last time. Morgan turned to Mrs. Neff.
I'm sorry about this, ma'am. He left me no choice. I'll be glad to cover the damage to your glass here.
He's been coming in here getting money for his boss ever since my husband died. Called it taxes. Extortion is what it was.
Morgan took her hand and stroked the back of it in an effort to calm her. Beaumont stooped to check on Patty, holding an open hand over the boy's gaping mouth. He looked up and shook his head.
He's dead.
Oh, Frankie. I'm sorry you got yourself in the middle of this. I know you were only trying to help me, but now you...
Oh, I'm sorry for you, ma'am. I reckon we need to report this. Who's the sheriff now?
The sheriff's name is Rance Whitehead, and you just killed one of his deputies.
Chaz Ferguson watched from the safety of a thick stand of cedars at the edge of town as Frank Morgan and his Texas Ranger friend swung onto their horses and trotted away to the south. He'd had Morgan figured completely wrong, assuming the dried-up gunfighter was a tired old man, until he'd watched him shoot back in Amarillo. Now, the way he swung effortlessly up on the back of his broad Appaloosa said the man wasn't anything close to being frail. Ferguson had seen the fight at Neff's through the large plate glass window in front. He'd watched the speed and dispassionate manner the gunfighter had used to dispatch his adversary, and then snuck off to hide under the shadowed cedar fronds before anyone saw him. The young dandy clutched his hat in one hand and used the other to steady himself on his saddle horn. An incredible dizziness had overwhelmed him when he witnessed the fight, and he'd had a difficult time staying on his feet. He knew Morgan was fast against another gunman, but up until that moment, he'd just heard stories. Seeing the drifter in action had had a much more sobering effect. Ferguson had been working up the courage to challenge Morgan since following him out of Amarillo. The young dandy knew he was faster than Morgan. There was no doubt in his mind about that. But there was so much more to a gunfight than mere speed. His uncle had taught him that. You had to get your mind right. Let things flow. That was the hard part. So many things could go wrong that you had to stop caring just a little. Ferguson's head reeled. His face felt flushed. He untied the canteen from his saddle strings and took a long swallow. His stomach rebelled at the cool water. It had been this way for days now, ever since Amarillo. Whenever he got within 100 yards of Frank Morgan, his insides turned to mush. If the gunfighter's voice drifted back on the wind, Ferguson would be seized with the sudden urge to turn tail and run away. He'd never in his life been afraid of another human being, and it galled him that Morgan drew out the weakness in him like an illness. Morgan was a sickness, that's what he was. A putrefying illness that festered inside the aspiring gunman and gnawed at him until he was less than half a man. There was no cure for a sickness like that. It had to be located and cut out before it had a chance to take over. There was only one way for Chaz Ferguson to be whole again. Frank Morgan had to die, and he had to kill him. Judge Isaiah Monfort was seated in an overstuffed leather chair behind an expansive oak desk that would have dwarfed a smaller man. Well-worn law books lined the built-in cases that flanked the walls behind him. Across the desk, Purnell tugged at his collar. Judge Monfort kept the window behind him open, and the smell of blooming irises and horse manure drifted in on the cool breeze. The lawyer's face was red as a beet, even in the cool air, and beads of sweat dotted his steep forehead. Monfort had never had much use for Purnell, considering him a mealy-mouthed attorney who could wind on for hours without ever getting to the point, which is exactly what he was doing at the moment.
I don't think I quite understand you, Purnell.
Oh, but I believe you will understand perfectly well if you would only think about it. Now, Your Honor, you have to listen to what I'm saying.
I've been listening to every word you've said, and I don't understand one damn syllable. All you do is talk in circles. I can only assume all this has something to do with that Crowder boy.
It does, Judge Monfort. I have to represent him as best as I can, but I don't have much of a case. Now, I have to tell you, his family gives me a few concerns, as well they should you. Concern you, I mean.
Hogwash, Purnell. Pure, unadulterated hogwash. If I let every outlaw's family give me the vapors, I'd be as useless as you are.
Your Honor, the boy's father told me to warn you. He says if you allow his son to hang, you would surely see the same end.
Excellent. That's exactly what I needed. I'll get Sheriff Whitehead to swear out a warrant for the old man threatening a judge. We can't have that sort of thing now, can we?
I suppose we can't. But the Crowders are pro-Stockyard, and the Smoot girl's parents are antis. It could look like they were using this as a platform to air their arguments with the Crowders' proposal. Maybe she led him on.
You really think that Ellie Smoot got herself molested by young Crowder so she could help her parents slander the family? More to the point, do you expect a jury would believe such nonsense?
I've seen worse.
Purnell, when a man hurts a girl so badly she very nearly bleeds to death, I doubt she was doing any leading. If a jury finds him guilty, the boy will hang. You can tell his mother I'm truly sorry for her if it comes to that. And you understand me on this. I know what Crowder's position is on this Stockyard issue, and I don't give a hoot in hell about it. What's more, I know that Whitehead happens to agree with him, but this has nothing to do with the yards or the railroad. This is about justice.
After Purnell slinked out of his chambers, the judge leaned back in his chair and swiveled it around to look at his second-floor window at the wagons on the square below. Across Main Street, Sheriff Whitehead's office door stood open, but the slimy lawman was nowhere in sight. Monfort had no doubt about how Silas Crowder felt about him, no doubt about the danger the wealthy patriarch posed if his family or fortune were threatened. As county sheriff, it was Whitehead's job to protect the judge from that kind of danger. But Whitehead was Crowder's man. It was only a matter of time before he would be forced to show his true colors. That time was more than likely to come just when the judge needed him the most. Monfort closed his eyes. This whole damned county was about to be torn apart, and there was very little he could do except watch it happen. A little south of Springtown, Wolf trotted out on point ahead of the two riders, nosing the air for signs of trouble, food, or fun. Any cottontail or red squirrel that happened to cross the scruffy cur's path didn't stand a chance. Thick stands of scrub oak and mesquite lined the dusty road, and a pink carpet of primroses covered the ground on either side. Their petals were pinched closed until the sun set in the evening, which was still another hour away. Here and there, a prickly pear cactus sprang up from the rocky ground in a jumbled pile of flat green ovals.
So, what do you aim to do? Just ride up and say, "Hello there, miss. I do believe I might be your pa."
I don't know that I plan to tell her anything at all. I expect I just need to see her, talk to her mama a bit. Mercy did say she needed my help. The Double Diamond spread is just over those limestone hills there. Before I do anything else, I plan to ride over and find out from Luke what's really going on around here. Sniff things out before I ride into the middle of something I don't understand. You're welcome to come with if you like. Luke always was a man for having company underfoot.
No, thanks. I believe I'd better go on in and do a little sniffing on my own. There's a ranger stationed over in Palo Pinto County. I'll send him a wire and see what he knows.
Watch your bones, then. Don't get lost.
I'll hook up with you tomorrow. When I get to town, I'll stop by and tell the sheriff you're on your way in to talk to him about the business with one of his deputies. I can say I witnessed the whole thing. That should help smooth matters out some. I'll leave word of where I'm staying with him in case, you know, you need to get in touch with me tonight. Help!
Morgan trotted Stormy onto Double Diamond Land just before sunset. The sun was behind him, and he cast a long shadow across the dusty wagon road. Before the Perkins Ranch House was even visible, Wolf perked up his ears.
Yeah, Luke's got dogs of his own, I reckon. See if you can behave yourself around here. I haven't got too many friends left in this world.
The Double Diamond covered most of four sections of prime grazing land, with the house and ranch headquarters set well back from the perimeter. The crickets were singing, and it was well into dusk by the time Morgan trotted up in front of the main house. Two black and white cattle dogs scampered off the front porch and trotted out to sniff Wolf. There was some low growling and a fair amount of polite whining before the whole mess of them ran off to get acquainted. The Perkins house was a sprawling, two-story affair, large enough to take in plenty of the hard luck strays Luke liked to adopt, and fancy enough to reflect the size and worth of the ranch. It had whitewashed wood-lap siding and a cedar-shaped roof. Fresh green paint trimmed the windows and covered the posts that supported a long wraparound porch. The solid front door yawned open a crack, and light spilled out as Frank dismounted and tied Stormy to a little stone jockey holding an iron ring. Luke Perkins stepped out of the door in his stockinged feet. His bald head reflected the golden lamplight that surrounded him.
Well, I swear, it's Frank Morgan. Well, you didn't die after all.
Well, no, I didn't, Luke. What are you doing without your boots at this time of day? It's not like you to go to bed just because the sun does.
Morgan stepped up onto the wooden porch and shook his friend's hand. Perkins ducked his head and looked up with sheepish eyes.
Oh, Carolyn likes us to take off our boots when we come in the house. Says all the horse poop is hard on the new rugs.
She civilized you, huh? Do I have to leave my gun outside, too?
No. And the way things are going around here, I'd advise you to keep it handy all the time. Come on inside and I'll fill you in. But you have to leave your boots there on that jockey or Carolyn will raise holy hell. Ah, it sure is good to see you, partner.
I seem to remember you were quite the coffee drinker.
Carolyn Perkins put a heavy mug on the table in front of Morgan, next to a plate piled high with oatmeal cookies. She was the picture of health, glowing with happiness in her new home, and a baby in her belly that wasn't far from making an appearance. A far cry from the last time he'd seen her. Carolyn rested her hand on Luke's shoulder and sidled up next to him.
I was awfully sorry to hear about Dixie. She was such a good woman. Saw us through some awful times, she did.
Her face was drawn as she spoke, but she didn't cry. Frank supposed the poor woman had shed enough tears for a dozen lifetimes. He'd been fearing the moment he'd have to talk to someone about his dead wife. The scars from losing her seemed more hurtful than the wounds on his own body. He swallowed hard, started to say something, but found there was nothing to say that didn't make the event sound small. Instead, he changed the subject. Morgan looked down at his feet.
I swear, Luke, I haven't had to take my boots off in front of civilized folks for some time now. My old socks seen better days, that's for certain.
His big toe stuck out the end of a hole in his right sock. He wiggled it to break the awkward situation.
Oh, I'll fetch you a pair of Luke's to wear while I wash and darn those. Shuck them off and give them to me. If you've got any other mending that needs doing, let me have it tonight. I'll have it done by tomorrow.
Morgan peeled off his socks.
We ought to just burn them. A few weeks on the trail can ruin a garment.
Carolyn snatched them away from him and started for the stairs.
Nonsense! No use throwing away what a little thread and time can fix. It is good to see you, Mr. Morgan. I hope you know you're welcome here as long as you want to stay.
Perkins watched his wife disappear up the stairs. There was a light in the cowboy's eyes when she was near him. Even his drooping mustache seemed to perk up at her presence.
Seems like she's treating you well.
Oh, better than well. She's due to drop that young'un in less than a month. But she won't hear of having someone come in and help with the chores. Well, next week I aim to hire a girl no matter what she says. Berta and B. Fossman help out a bunch, but they're busy with their schooling and all.
It's good to set foot on home soil. I'll say that much.
Well, you're likely wondering about Mercy.
She did send for me. I reckon I could have treated her some better back then.
You know she married?
Yeah, I know. You told me that a long time ago. But you never told me she had a daughter.
I didn't figure it was any of my business.
How old is she, this daughter?
Well, Mercy married Isaiah Monfort only a few weeks after you left town. He was just a young attorney then, new in town and without many prospects. The baby came sometime later. Close enough, it could go either way, if that's what you're wondering.
Frank didn't speak for a time. This was a lot of information to try and digest. He'd heard from Mercy Monfort a grand total of 3 times in the last 2+ decades. If the girl was his, why hadn't she mentioned it?
She's older than you'll remember her.
I'm getting a little long in the tooth myself.
You remember that soft way Mercy used to talk with that Southern Belle drawl? Like she was fresh off a plantation in Alabama.
I do.
Well, it's as soft a drawl as ever. And I believe her daughter has inherited it.
Morgan felt uncomfortable talking any more about Mercy and such things, especially on the heels of so many fresh thoughts of Dixie. He needed to change the subject.
What did you mean about how things are around here? Ever since I got the telegram from Mercy, all I hear is how something sinister is going on in Parker County.
Remember when we were kids and all there was to worry about was getting scalped by a Comanche or drowning in the Brazos River?
Don't forget the whiskey peddlers from Arkansas.
Now, the thing is, a man used to know who his enemies were. Nowadays, it could be anybody. Even someone you've known for years who puts the spurs to you. The railroad wants to put a spur through the county seat so they can situate a stockyard. Well, they're trying to decide between here and Fort Worth. There are those who would kill to have it, and others who are just as fiercely against it. The two sides have done everything short of declaring open warfare on each other.
Guess you'd be one of the ones all for it, then. Stockyards in Parker County'd sure make it easier for you to get your cattle to market.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? Stockyard and railroad would make things a hell of a lot easier. But I'm against it. Yeah, Fort Worth is plenty close for me. Cow towns just aren't the kind of places to raise a family, my way of thinking. Well, they bring in all sorts of riffraff. Too many of those damn cowboys and drifters. Besides that, you know how I like the trail. A week or so just seems like a vacation.
I see what you mean. There are 2 sides to this, but none of it should be enough to get people's blood boiling.
It's always about money. The land the railroad is considering is smack on a chunk of otherwise worthless rock and snake pasture owned by an old patriarch named Silas Crowder.
Never heard of him.
Nah, you wouldn't have. He moved in with his family about 10 years after you took to the trail. Real rank man, that one. Meaner than a rabid badger. He runs his sons, and everybody else for that matter, like he's the almighty himself. Well, if the railroad chooses Parker County, he stands to double his net worth overnight. And he's already worth quite a bit. Now, for some folks, it's just a debate. For Crowder, that's enough to kill over.
So what's all the fuss about if the railroad hasn't even chosen where they want to put it yet?
Parker County has decided to vote on the issue to see if we'll even allow the railroad to consider us. God, you'd think we'd talking secession again, the way everybody's worked into a lather over this.
Anybody on the opposing side is vocal or stand to lose as much as this Crowder?
Well, there's all kinds of good folk besides me against the sudden boom the stockyards would bring. The Baptist Church has spoken out strongly in favor of keeping Parker County Stockyard and sin-free. Of course, they're against near everything. Dancing, gambling, even liquor by the drink. So far, no one of them have gone anywhere past a little fisticuffs. Mercy's husband, Judge Monfort, is the most outspoken of what everybody's calling the anti-crowd. And Crowder's youngest boy, Tom, has gotten himself in a speck of trouble misusing one of our local girls. He ended up in a jail, and Crowder's making it seem like it's all about the stockyards.
How about the sheriff?
Frank filled Luke in on the incident with Mrs. Neff in Springtown.
Whew, that's not good, Frankie. Whitehead's a bad one. Crowder backed his campaign and helped him get into office. He's in the old man's back pocket, that's for certain. Now, if I was you, I'd make sure that ranger friend of mine was with me when I went in to explain everything. Whitehead's the type to shoot you and then figure out a reason later. He's smart, Frankie. He's smart and he's got a lot to lose. Besides that, he's meaner than you by a long shot.
Meaner than me? That ain't likely. But even if he is, he still gotta beat me to the draw.
Ronald Purnell tugged at his high collar and wrung his hands together in his lap. He tried to keep them quiet, but found it hard to sit still. From the time he was a fidgety little boy, Purnell had been uncomfortable around people with money. His own family hadn't had much, and he'd always felt like the rest of the world looked down on him because of it. He knew the Crowders were well-to-do ranchers with enough money to buy him 10 times over. Money wasn't the only thing about the family that set the lawyer's nerves on edge. Old Silas Crowder had a reputation for staring people to death with his one good eye. The story was that a black crow had swooped down out of a crepe myrtle bush and pecked out the old man's eye. The way Purnell heard it, Silas Crowder caught the bird and strangled it to death with his bare hands to try and get his eye back. He was a hard man, and hard men with money were the worst. Crowder land stretched nearly to Tarrant County. Except for the poor parcel that the railroad wanted to buy, the whole place was covered with fat cattle grazing on the grassy hills. Native grasses sprang up in a vast blue-green carpet, with bright patches of bluebonnets scattered between groves of post oak and cedar. The land looked bright and alive. The ranch house was a different story. From the outside, it looked all but abandoned. Paint peeled and split on the wood siding. Several weathered boards on the front porch had creaked badly when Purnell arrived, and he'd been afraid he might fall through. Except for the thin curdle of smoke coming out of the crumbling stone chimney and the telltale glow of lamplight through dusty windows, the dilapidated house looked like it was about to fall down on its own foundation. The lawyer supposed it was because the place was kept up by the old man and his boys without the benefit of a feminine touch. In the parlor, Purnell found himself surrounded by the tintype photographs of a half dozen dour members of the Crowder family. The women, dressed in high collars and severe hairstyles, looked as stone-faced and dangerous as the bearded men in Confederate gray. A layer of dust did nothing to dull the harsh stares coming from each of the stern portraits. The hardwood floor in the parlor was cloudy and streaked from a lack of waxing. No female would have abided such a thing. From what Purnell understood, Mrs. Crowder had once been a beautiful woman, shy and withdrawn around others, and she'd always kept a tidy house. Now he could hear her quiet babbling through the peeling white door that connected the parlor to the kitchen. The incomprehensible noises sounded like a gurgling infant. Purnell jumped like a guilty child when the door swung suddenly open. Pete, the oldest Crowder boy, stood there staring and let the door swing shut behind him. He had hard brown eyes and a thick brow that ran together into one fuzzy line above his pug nose. He was ham-fisted and clumsy, with a lumbering walk that shook the house to the timbers with each plodding step.
Paul says you should come in the kitchen and talk to him in there.
Purnell had hoped to avoid this. Mrs. Crowder was known for throwing tantrums now and again. When she did, it embarrassed the old man. When Silas Crowder was embarrassed, there was no telling what he might do.
My pa wants to see you in the kitchen, so you best get yourself moving. He don't like to be kept waiting.
Purnell gathered up his hat and coat and followed Pete into the kitchen. He tried to keep his eyes off the swaying, gurgling Mrs. Crowder and focused instead on the old man who sat at a long oak table feeding, or attempting to feed, his wife some sort of cornmeal mush. Silas Crowder was dressed in tan canvas breeches and a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up to reveal a thick rug of hair on his massive forearms. The hair on his head and face had gone white as ash and was swept back as if he'd been riding into a hard wind without a hat. A black leather patch covered his left eye. A bit of jagged pink scar was still visible underneath. His right eye remained free to burn a hole straight through Purnell's chest if that was what he decided to do. Luckily for the lawyer, the old man was in a talkative mood.
Having trouble to get her to eat this evening.
Crowder used a small wooden spoon to push the mush into Mrs. Crowder's mouth. The poor woman sat in her straight-backed wooden chair, staring blankly into space. Her mouth was clenched shut in a tight line. Her lifeless yellow hair hung damp from a fresh washing around frail shoulders. Purnell noticed a large galvanized tub beside the wood stove where Crowder must have bathed her. Bits of the mush dribbled down her chin and fell on the ragged red woolen shawl draped across her lap. He thought how much smarter it would have been to attempt to feed the poor woman before trying to bathe her, but kept the idea to himself. There were worn spots around the uprights on the chair back, as if someone had been tied there with a rope. Purnell looked away and willed himself not to think about such a thing. He was certain things went on inside this house he did not want to know about.
What did His Honor have to say?
Crowder used a cloth napkin to wipe away the mush on his wife's chin.
Mr. Crowder, the judge will not give an inch. He's firmly entrenched with his own views.
Entrenched, you say? That figures. I can't say as I expected anything different from the pompous old son of a bitch.
I can promise you I'll give your boy the best defense possible.
Tommy would still hang. You know that, don't you? He'd hang because he's a damned idiot. Sometimes I think it's a blessing that my Rebecca is unaware of how truly ignorant her boys are.
As if she'd recognized her name, Mrs. Crowder began to buzz, pursing her lips together and spewing mush in a sort of forced hum. She rocked back and forth slowly in her seat. Her dull eyes stared at nothing.
I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to whip him bloody for that fool behavior, especially right now with so much at stake. But I can't let him hang. That would break his poor mother's heart for sure, whenever she does come around.
You want that me and Pony should go and bust Tommy out of jail?
Any other time, that would be fine, but not now. We need to be quieter about it all. We gotta convince the judge it would be in his best interest to let the boy go. His family has too much riding on the stockyard vote to stir the whole town up with a jailbreak.
Mrs. Crowder began to smack her mouth like she was ready for some more mush. At first, Purnell thought she might be smiling. If she had anything to smile about, he couldn't see what it was. The old man took up his wooden spoon again and stabbed it into the bowl of congealed cornmeal mush.
Judge Monfort, he's got himself a daughter, don't he?
He does, but Mr. Crowder, I
You know
I really...
where this high and mighty judge lives?
I can find it.
Purnell pointed out to you. Now listen to me, Pete. You try not to hurt the girl if you can help it. Once you have her, you and Pony carry her out to the line cabin along Little Cottonwood Creek.
Mr. Crowder, I don't see how I can be a party to a kidnapping. I mean, if I'm in jail, I won't be able to help with Tom's trial.
When we have the Monfort girl, there won't be any need of a trial. Now get moving, both of you.
Purnell opened his mouth to continue his protest, but Pete glared at him from under a bushy forehead. Old Man Crowder sat slumped in his chair, wooden spoon in hand, staring forlornly at the pathetic figure of his damaged wife. Purnell stood dumbfounded, not knowing what to say or do. He felt a pang of pity for the old man.
We need to leave them alone. Let's go, now.
Damn.
Old Man Crowder put his face in his hands and began to sob. His shoulders shook with grief, while his wife just sat there. Purnell tore his gaze away, turned on his heels, and fled through the door to the parlor behind Pete.
Pa don't like it when anyone sees him get all down like that. He don't like it one bit. Now move your ass. We got us a girl to steal.
Purnell followed slowly, shuffling along without any will of his own, like people he'd seen in an opium daze. This was all wrong. He was clinging fast to a runaway train that was moving much too fast for him to jump off, at least not without breaking his neck. Judge Isaiah Monfort made it his habit to work late on Wednesdays because his wife attended her weekly women's auxiliary meeting on that particular evening. Although Victoria got along well enough with her mother and enjoyed lively debates with her father, she guarded her time home alone on those evenings like a precious treasure. For as long as she could remember, she had preferred her own company to that of anyone else. She'd yet to find a man who interested her remotely enough to make the prospect of marriage seem at all appetizing. Often, when she was out for a ride by herself, she had to fight the urge to just keep riding, if only to see what was over the next rise. It wasn't the dangers that kept her from leaving, or any sort of fear of the unknown. If anything, these were the things that beckoned to her the loudest. The only thing Victoria Monfort feared was hurting her parents. They'd be heartbroken if she just wandered away the way she dreamt of doing. Though she hardly ever spoke of it, Victoria knew her mother had been hurt before, desperately hurt by someone who had wandered away, someone she'd loved more than anything in the world. So, instead of following her dreams of travel, Victoria read books, any books she could get her hands on. Books about sailing the seven seas, books about gunfighters in the Wild West, books about Europe. She didn't care, as long as they took her somewhere else and allowed her to wander, allowed her to drift. The day had been a warm one for April, but at sunset, a cool wind had freshened out to the north. Victoria planned to have a long, soaking bath with her new Charles Dickens novel. It was supposed to be about the French Revolution, full of intrigue and such. Peggy Langford said it had made her cry. Just the sort of book for a long, soaking bath. Dressed in a thick cotton robe, Victoria padded barefoot through the house, closing all the windows and drawing the drapes. That done, she stoked up the fire in the kitchen stove and checked to make certain the copper hot water box attached to the side was full. Tiny bubbles formed along the side next to the stove, signifying the water was just about the perfect temperature for the kind of skin-pinking bath she enjoyed while she relaxed with her book. Gallows, her father's red bird dog, lay curled up on his blanket next to the box of kindling, warming his old bones. Flecks of white had crept into the hair around the faithful dog's muzzle. Victoria stooped to rub his ears.
So what do you think, boy? Would a railhead and stockyards be a blessing or a curse to Parker County? How do you plan to vote? Come on and tell me what you think, boy. I trust your opinion as much as Reed White.
The dog suddenly came to his feet. His eyes glowed and locked on the kitchen window. Victoria shot a quick glance over her shoulder at the window, then looked back at the dog. His growling grew more intense. Victoria tightened the sash on her robe. If she was going to have to confront an intruder, she'd wished she'd worn something a little more practical. Her father wasn't due back for another hour. Even then, he knew she would be in the kitchen having a bath, so he would never come in that way if he decided to come home early. Victoria glanced quickly around the room, sizing up her situation. If she was going to have to fight half naked, she would need a weapon. She reached behind the kindling box and grabbed the 3-foot wrought iron fire poker just as Gallows broke into a violent frenzy of barks and snarls. The rattling at the door changed to a heavy knock. Victoria stood beside the kitchen stove, clutching the iron poker.
Who is it? Who's there?
Need to leave some papers for the judge.
You'll find him still at his chambers.
Victoria cringed and cursed her stupidity as the words escaped her lips. She might as well have told them she was home all alone. Victoria thanked her lucky stars she'd been about to have a bath. Otherwise, the door would not have been locked. There had never before been a need. She heard glass shatter as a window broke in the side parlor. Gallows bristled and growled again before tearing through the swinging door out of the kitchen toward the noise. The back door bowed on its hinges as someone outside put a shoulder to it. Victoria considered screaming, but dismissed the idea. She really wasn't the screaming type. Beyond that, the women in the surrounding houses were all at the same auxiliary meeting as her mother. Their husbands likely used that as an excuse to leave the house and go down to one of the local saloons to do their weekly carousing. She could yell at the top of her lungs, even fire a 21-gun salute, and no one would be likely to hear her. Instead, she doused the gas lamp and moved up closer to the door to meet the intruder head-on. It was dark, but she had the advantage of knowing where everything was. As she passed the kitchen counter, she transferred the poker to her left hand and snatched a large meat cleaver off the cutting board for good measure. She tensed as the door bowed in again. Wood flew out in splinters. A booted foot crashed through a jagged hole under the knob. She took a swipe with the cleaver, but whoever belonged to the boot drew it back quickly and she missed. She caught her breath and stood by, waiting. Her heart pounded in her ears. Gallows snarled in the other room, barking and howling as if he had something treed. Slowly, a hand felt its way through the new opening in the door. Stubby fingers reached up, searching for the lock. Victoria grasped the cleaver firmly and swung with all her might. This time, she didn't miss. The hand, minus the ends of 2 fingers, jerked back through the hole. Rather than dissuade the intruder, the injury seemed to infuriate him, and he redoubled his efforts to get through the door. the entire door flew off its hinges and crashed into the butcher block. A crouching figure followed it in. The figure stood up straight to get his bearings, just in time to get a snoop full of twisted fire poker. Victoria had dropped the cleaver, figuring the heavy iron bar a better weapon for close fighting. She swung with both hands, putting her hips into it. She hit him again across the back and was about to follow up with another to his swaying head when a shot rang out in the next room.
Oh, no!
It's a damn dog, dumbass. Pa said not to hurt the girl. I don't think he'd mind it if we shot a dog.
Why don't you just shut up and get on with this?
The other voice was strained and tense, like the man didn't really want to be there. Victoria thought she recognized it, but couldn't quite put a finger on who it belonged to. She let her eyes play around the dark kitchen, trying to decide what to do next. She couldn't stay where she was.
Oh, Jesus.
The man on the floor tried to push himself to his feet. He wore a black hood over his head with two large holes cut out so he could see. It looked like the same kind of hood they put on people who were about to hang. Victoria looked at the demolished back door, but decided against trying to escape that way in case there were more men outside watching the horses. In the books she'd read, they always left someone to guard the horses. The door past the stove led to her parents' bedroom. Beyond that was her father's study. He kept his guns in there. Victoria gave the man at her feet another whack on the noggin, just to be sure he wouldn't follow, and ran for the door. She'd never fired any of her father's pistols, but he taught her to use his shotgun when she was 12. Up until he'd re-injured his leg, they'd gone to shoot doves in the maize field at the edge of town every fall. He'd been surprised at her skill. Now, she tore at the coats in the closet of his study, pulling out the long double barrel from its hiding place in the back. A paper bag of shells hung on a peg beside the gun, and she had it loaded in no time. She could hear footsteps drifting in from the kitchen. Dogs barked up and down the street. She wondered if anyone had heard the earlier shot. Backing up to the far wall, Victoria hid behind the corner of her father's heavy oak desk. She aimed the loaded shotgun at the door and used the heel of her hand to pull back both hammers. The first person into the room would meet a face full of birdshot. At this range, less than 15 feet, that meant he wouldn't have much of a face left, or a head for that matter. She held her breath and waited, almost wishing for someone to come through the door. Getting shot was an occupational hazard when you broke into other people's houses. Breaking in on a poor, defenseless woman like this, if someone got their head blown off, it would serve them right. Pony Crowder crouched low and played his pistol around the dark kitchen. Ronald Purnell turned up the gaslight on the wall.
Good Lord above! Look what she done to Pete!
Blood trickled from Pete's ear and pooled around his mouth, where it pressed up against a plush hand-woven rug. They pulled off their masks and looked around the room. Pony kneeled beside his addled brother.
Don't worry, Pete. I'll kill her for you.
Hey, Pony, your father told us not to hurt her. You remember that?
A cruel grin etched Pony's crooked face. His bottom jaw stuck out a good half inch further than his top, and he always seemed to have a string of drool dripping from the corner of his mouth.
Well, that was before she beat the hell out of poor Pete. I'm pretty sure he'd want me to kill her now.
Listen to me, Pony. We have to remember what we came for. Your pa doesn't want anything to mess up the vote, right?
No, I reckon that's so.
Well, that's what he wants. Take my word for it.
Pete pushed himself into a kneeling position. He held his head with his good hand.
Damn, that little bitch.
Pete staggered to unsteady feet, pulled off his mask, and stuck the nubs of his injured fingers behind his gun belt to stem the bleeding. He gave his brother a sullen gaze and looked like he might throw up.
I got a mind to kill her too, Pony. Maybe we'll get the chance later. But Paul would do worse to me than she did if we don't carry on just like he told us.
She must have run in there.
Purnell nodded toward the door that led to the master bedroom.
We'd best hurry before she goes out a window.
The front door creaked open, then shut again. At first, the lawyer thought it was the Monfort girl slipping out. He half hoped it was, even though there would be hell to pay with old man Crowder if they came back empty-handed. At least then he might not hang for kidnapping. He had no such luck. Footsteps approached the kitchen.
What the deuce?
A strange thudding tap accompanied the footsteps. A cane, Judge Monfort had come home early. Pete Crowder happened to be the closest to the kitchen door when the judge came in, and the hapless outlaw caught the brass knob of his cane square in his prominent forehead, splitting his thick eyebrow down to his nose. Pete slumped to the ground. The judge wheeled on his good leg, cane raised, seeking a new target. When he saw Purnell, he paused, a puzzled look creasing his jowled face. Monfort had recognized him. The lawyer was as good as dead now.
Judge Monfort, if you just listen, I'm sure...
What the deuce are you doing in my home, Purnell? Where's my daughter?
Your Honor, you must hear me out.
Your Honor, me? What have you done with my daughter?
Pony pointed his pistol directly at the back of the judge's head. His normally cross-eyed look cleared for an instant. His tongue flicked out to lick his lips, a sure sign he was about to do something. Purnell prayed he wouldn't shoot. Instead, he did the next worst thing. He clubbed Judge Monfort on the side of the head. The judge lay still, a heavy arm trailing across Pete's ankle. Purnell stooped over the bodies and relaxed a notch when he saw they were both breathing.
You could have killed him, you idiot!
He heard the click of a revolver behind his ear.
I'll be killing me somebody, all right. Pa never said word about not killing you. Just as soon as you call me an idiot again, I'm gonna splatter your brains from here to Sunday. Now, I know I ain't none too smart, but I ain't no idiot. Comprende?
I understand. We still have to find the girl.
What do we need the girl for? We supposed to get the daughter so we can make up the judge's mind. Now we got the judge, so we just make up his mind directly. Comprende?
I don't think that's what your father had in mind.
You're scared of my pa, ain't you? Fact is, I reckon you're scared of me and the judge and even that teensy little girl that whacked old Pete a good one. You're likely scared of your own shadow. Fact is, I bet you're this close to peeing down your own leg.
Purnell didn't say a word. He just looked at the gun barrel pointed at him and clenched his teeth, hoping the boy didn't see his knees shaking. Pony holstered his pistol and sneered.
Well, you help Pete, and I get the judge. Pete's lighter. I doubt you got the strength to lift a teacup, let alone his royal highness here.
Safe from being killed for the time being, Purnell knelt and helped a groggy and bleeding Pete Crowder to his feet. The judge had seen Purnell's face, but it really didn't matter that he'd come along. The Crowders would likely decide to kill him anyway. If they were caught, and they surely would be caught, they would all hang.